I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined. Born in Austria in the late 1800s, Sigmund Freud arguably remains the world's most famous psychologist. However, in today's world, Freud's name is barely a footnote.
We're kind of embarrassed by him as a field. To some extent, I think modern psychologists see him as if we're sort of a pharmaceutical company that got its start by selling meth. It's Freud as an embarrassment with his florid claims about penis envy and Oedipal complex, his bizarre personal interactions, his cult-like following.
Controversial, bizarre, and polarizing, what is Freud's legacy?
I think all modern psychologists accept a primacy of the unconscious. The idea that there are systems in your head and beliefs and desires and motivations that you're not aware of is right now is bread and butter psychology. And whether we credit him or not, we owe that to Freud.
Paul Bloom on Sigmund Freud's singular impact on the field of psychology and why he remains relevant today. That's all coming up on Life Examined. Imagine a therapy session, not the virtual kind over the phone or Zoom, but the one where the patient lies back on a couch and the therapist sits behind listening and engaged. It's a classic scene made famous in Hollywood movies and in TV series like The Sopranos. And while free association in the practice of modern psychotherapy has evolved somewhat, its origins belong to the renowned yet controversial 19th century neuroscientist Sigmund Freud. Perhaps it's unfortunate that Freud remains best known as the sex-obsessed psychoanalyst, espousing theories on dreams, oral fixations, phallic symbols, or marrying your mother, most of which have long been debunked. But his legacy in the field of psychology is relevant and significant. Paul Bloom is professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, the author of The Sweet Spot, and he joins me now to discuss the complicated legacy of Freud. Paul Bloom, welcome to Life Examined. Great to have you back.
I'm thrilled to be back. This should be great.
I start with kind of my own funny story about Freud, or I guess the lack of Freud in my life. When I became a therapist and I went, you know, to study clinical psychology, I kind of assumed I would be studying Freud on some level, right? Like, it would be a core part of my curriculum, thinking that this was the grandfather of psychology. And maybe he was like a footnote that we got to for half of a lecture. And I want to start with that because I feel like he is a central figure that is maybe become less central, but his tendrils, I'm sure, go everywhere through psychology. How do you make sense of that story as somebody who's written so much about him and no doubt thinks about his place in psychology today?
Yeah, we're going to get to this, but I think he plays a central role in psychology and has some tremendously important insights. But we're kind of embarrassed by him as a field. And so undergraduates come to universities and they're sort of shocked to hear that nobody's talking about Freud. And to some extent, I think modern psychologists see him as if we're sort of a pharmaceutical company that got its start by selling meth. In that it's just really, it's Freud as an embarrassment with his florid claims about penis envy and Oedipal complex, his bizarre personal interactions, his cult-like following. And now we're a science, so we want none of him. And so, as a result, I think we are neglecting his real and important lasting contributions because we're so embarrassed by the stuff, which, quite honestly, a lot of his stuff is terrible, is embarrassing.
Well, let's just think about where he kind of would come from. Like, what era of thought does Freud arrive into? And was psychology even a field at that point?
It wasn't a scientific area of study like it is now. Psychologists didn't have laboratories. There wasn't a sort of experimental field studying the mind in the same way there is now. But Freud saw himself as a neuroscientist. He was, of course, a doctor, and he viewed himself as a theorist of the brain and was interdisciplinary in a way that you don't see much nowadays. He wrote books about Leonardo da Vinci, about the origin of civilization, about evolution. He studied brain damage and neuroscience. And of course, he was a clinician, spending so many of his hours working with patients and trying to sort of figure out what's going on with them. He just tremendous, brilliant polymath. Who started this field of psychoanalysis, developed pretty much what you could call a cult following, had complicated and often immoral relationships with the people he dealt with. And there's no figure now that's anything close to Freud, either in influence or in scope.
Interesting. Can you give us just a little kind of taste of his biography as to where he grew up? It sounds like he was someone that just had, he himself had an incredible mind and an intellect and interest in ideas of all sorts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a historian. I'm mostly right. interested in his writings and his ideas. But the capsule story is he was born in 1856. He spent most of his life in Vienna. Didn't tend to live in many places. Developed his practice. Developed his collaborations. And when in the rise of the Third Reich, he left, and he left pretty much just in time. And ended up in London, where he spent the rest of his life. Died of cancer, I think cancer of the mouth, because of his very extreme cigar habit, which he refused to give up. And was tremendously influential in his lifetime. So it's, you know, if I asked you to name a psychologist, you'd say Freud. Right. I have a feeling that when Freud was around, people would also say Freud. though he was, and he is controversial now, and he was controversial then, and in part he was controversial, you know, in Germany at the time because of his Jewishness. His views were seen as deeply subversive, designed to sort of destroy the Christian edifice of morality. And you know, taking away the anti-Semitism, it's not a bad summary of Freud. He wanted to shock us. He told us things we'd rather not hear.
Yeah. Let's then explore some of the primary tenets that he would kind of bring online into the world of psychology, which was so new there. Obviously, you've referenced some of the sexual stuff and the desires or repression, but I'll let you kind of pick where you think the foundation of his work begins.
Yeah, I'll say a few things. One thing is he was a developmental psychologist, so he had a theory of development that was very psychosexual. With these different stages, the oral stage and the anal stage, where kids go through these stages, and they have challenges. The challenge in the oral stages is dealing with eating and breastfeeding. In the anal stage is toilet training. And Freud has a theory that if you get stuck at these stages, problems manifest themselves for the rest of your life. So you could have somebody who is in some way, say, very stingy and needy. And Freud may say that's an anal personality and blame inadequate toilet training later on.
Interesting.
Freud was a scientist of adult relations. He talked about defense mechanisms, some which we still talk about and are probably true. And Freud saw these as mechanisms in our mind that keep forbidden thoughts from rising to consciousness. So suppose I'm an abusive father and I like beating up on my kid, but it'd be horrible for me to realize that I like beating up on my kid. So I might rationalize it. I might say, no, it's for his own good. If I have a forbidden desire for somebody, maybe say for another man in Freud's time, I might invert it and say, oh, he's obsessed with me. And so Freud had the view that our conscious, that basically we live a life at war with ourselves, where we have all of these psychological systems designed to keep forbidden stuff from rising to consciousness. And I think there we get some of the glimmers of truth in Freud. So for me, I think a lot of the developmental stuff is nonsense. I think a lot of Freud's well-known claims, penis envy, phallic symbols, his interpretation of dreams, has very little empirical support and shouldn't be taken seriously. But his core idea was the idea of a dynamic unconscious, the idea that we're not rational computers sort of making our way through the world by making the best decisions in our own interest. Rather, there's this inner turmoil, a lot which goes beneath the surface. And so Freud made a very radical claim that that we don't know why we feel what we feel. We don't know why we do what we do. And if you think about it, it's really shocking. You know, I ask you why you chose the job you did, and I'm sure you have a story. But Freud would say, why should we believe your story? Your story is a story, but there's true forces that guided you to do what you do, to love who you love, that you were just unaware of. And I think there Freud is largely correct. And most modern psychologists, I think all modern psychologists, accept a primacy of the unconscious. Mm. And whether we, you know, whether we credit him or not, we owe that to Freud.
How radical was that notion at the time? I mean, both the idea of the unconscious, but that there were these forbidden desires, these taboo things in our life we didn't really want to access, or we didn't know where they would come from. I mean, was this emerging out of a, you know, a more puritanical society, or like how would this stuff have been received when he was bringing it up?
Probably largely with shock and horror and fascination. Mm. If nobody would ever say that Freud discovered the unconscious. You know, through history, many scholars, long before Freud, talked about unconscious processes, talked about things we didn't know about. But he took it and ran with it. He built a systematic system of thought, incredibly complicated system of thought, that took the unconscious very seriously. And then there was the issue of sex. So Freud was, you know, obsessed with sexuality, saw this as the core of everything that we are, of everything going on. He talked about the primal scene. So for Freud, the primal scene is when a child stumbles in on his parents having sex. And you might think, well, that's this weird little thing that sometimes happened. But for Freud, it's deeply important. Freud talked about the Oedipal complex, where the boy falls in love with his mother and wants to kill his father. And the resolution of that is the emergence of the conscience, which is why, according to Freud, men have consciences and morality and women don't, because they don't go through an Oedipal complex. So you have these radical theories that put sex at the forefront. Combine that with his ideas about the unconscious, and it's not surprising that in his puritanical Victorian time, his views were seen as so shocking.
Interesting. Just out of curiosity, and this is maybe a very basic question, but when we think about what the unconscious is, like how would you define it, or how was Freud defining it?
So Freud had a complicated notion of the unconscious. He distinguished the preconscious from the unconscious. Preconscious is stuff you're not thinking about now, but rests in your head until it's called to mind, and everybody accepts that. But the Freudian idea of the unconscious is motivations and thoughts and beliefs and ideas that are not accessible to conscious thought. So it's defined in terms of what it isn't, which is it isn't something that I could ask you about. If you could answer as honestly as you can, as forthrightly as you can, and you can't access this. If you may say, take a very Freudian example, hate your father. But if it's unconscious, you wouldn't know it. You'd be shocked if somebody said that to you. But Freud said, we're not at a loss here. The unconscious can slip out in all sorts of ways. It slips out in dreams when properly interpreted. It slips out in speech errors.
Right.
It slips out in jokes. It slips out in cultural inventions like fairy tales. And I think a lot of the focus of Freud, say his focus on jokes, modern psychologists don't follow him as tightly. But the idea that there are systems in your head and beliefs and desires and motivations that you're not aware of is right now is bread and butter psychology. Take political psychology. A lot of people are interested in why people would vote for Biden or vote for Trump. And you might think, well, just ask people and they'll tell you. But nobody believes this is a good way of finding out. We accept, and I think most people, even who aren't psychologists, would probably accept you could have reasons for why you're voting for one versus the other that you're just not aware of, that we could figure out in complex ways by looking at surveys and looking at I don't know, studying brain activation or studying other aspects of why people make decisions. But if you ask people, tell me the truth, why are you doing it? They'll have a story, but a story is probably not right.
That's, I think, a really great description of what the unconscious is. And I want to come back to that in a second, because I know it's going to relate to psychoanalysis. But let's get back to the embarrassing Freud stuff, the sexual stuff, for a second. I mean, is it too obvious to say that he might have just been a guy that was just super interested in sex? Like, he was a highly sexual person himself and was interpreting the world that way? Or do you think he was really trying to make what he thought were objective claims about the way he understood the world, as if maybe we can really uncouple any of this stuff anyway? But like, what's your thought on that?
I tend to be charitable here. A lot of people have problems with Freud's personality. Mm-hmm. I have a quote here from a biographer, Frederick Cruz. And a summary of his view on Freud is, I'm going to read this aloud.
Yep.
Liar, cheat, incestuous child molester, woman hater, money worshiper, chronic plagiarist, and all around nasty nut job.
Wow. So, very fun.
You know, that's quite the letter of reference you got there. But I actually, Freud's own sexual lives, he was not this bizarrely promiscuous person. He didn't seem personally obsessed with sex in his regular life. I think it's just an idea he had. I'll give him credit and say, as a scientist, he says, we're not looking at this enough. Mm. It's forbidden. And in fact, the very fact that it's forbidden is itself interesting. That you know how troubled we are by sex. And let me say something nice about Freud, which is I think his obsession with sex is bizarre and inappropriate. There's so many other motivations going on, so much else that explains our psychic lives. But at the same time, there's something I think sort of socially positive about his obsession with sex, because he kind of argued that everybody is in some sense a pervert. And if everybody's a pervert, nobody's a pervert. So he sort of said, you know, you take the sort of things that the people around him would say were disgusting and forbidden, like homosexuality. And Freud would, you know, Freud was not particularly progressive about homosexuality, but at times he kind of said, well, you know, this is sexuality, and that may be strange, but heterosexuality is also strange. And his obsession with sex, I think, made the world a little bit better for people whose sexual desires were themselves not typical.
Well, that's what I was wondering. I mean, whether or not you agree with the content of his sexual theories, I mean, this would at least open up conversations or allow for conversations about sexuality that maybe, as you suggested, really probably were not happening at that time.
That's right. That's right. And in some way, you could say his obsession about it is a sort of a natural reaction to the fact that people weren't talking about it at all. Hmm. And the truth is probably somewhere in between. But without Freud making a strong case for it, we wouldn't be able to give sexuality its proper role in our lives.
Hmm. And, you know, just as we have this conversation, you mentioned, again, referring to his developmental theories or the way he thought about the unconscious, like just the way that he is still a part of our language, like the Freudian slip we still say all the time. And, you know, I don't know if this is also one, but we call people anal sometimes.
Yes.
Or, you know, we even use the idea of oral fixation. This stuff, I take it, does trace back to him to a certain extent.
Oh, it definitely does. Everybody who's at some point screams at her husband, I'm not your mother, you know, is in some sense channeling Freud. Maybe one reason why we don't give Freud the credit that he deserves is because his ideas have become so much of our common sense picture of the world. And, you know, in some way he's doomed by his own success. Hmm. Where before Freud, it was probably very odd to assume that we could be wrong about our own feelings, wrong about our motivations. But now it's not just part of psychology, but it's part of everyday assumptions. And yeah, so we have that broader picture, and then we have terms like Freudian slip, or somebody being an anal personality, or the idea that that even stuff like a boy falling in love with his mother. Hmm. Which I think, again, is something Freud was mistaken to take in as a core aspect of development, but happens.
Okay.
And the idea that there's in some sense in which kids are, you wouldn't want to call them sexual beings, but they do have desires and crushes and things that I think verge on adult sexuality, which I think people are uncomfortable talking about. But again, Freud gets credit for bringing this to light.
Well, it's interesting to think about the kind of pop psychological ideas out there, which we don't even know where to attribute, and I don't know where to attribute them either. But I mean, the idea, for example, of, you mentioned that a scenario in which a wife might say, I'm not your mother. But I mean, we grow up, I think, with this idea of being like, oh yeah, we're all kind of secretly looking for a version of our mother to marry or a father figure to marry. I mean, is that actually Freudian or is that just something else? Because that seems to still be everywhere from what I can tell.
Yeah, I don't know. It definitely sounds Freudian to me. I think that mode of thought, the mode of thought that says, you know, you might say you're looking for somebody who's kind and beautiful and warm and smart and all of those things, but maybe you're looking for something else. And maybe you're looking for something that you don't know. You don't even know why you're looking for it. Maybe you're looking for somebody who's not good for you.
Right.
Because, you know, you've had abusive relationships early in life and you're trying to imitate these relationships now to your great cost. These are very Freudian ideas. And I guess if I had to put it in a sentence, just about all the details of his ideas, all the specific claims about the anal stage and Oedipal complex and all that, they're all bogus, but the core idea that these unconscious processes rule us is important and significant.
Well, let's talk about how then he would work with clients, because if I have this right, I mean, psychoanalysis was one of his gifts to the world of some level, but I'll let you talk about that. I mean, is he the founder of what we now think of as a therapist and client sitting together and allowing for ideas to kind of come forth in a place that we feel is safe and holy to a certain extent and outside of the judgment of society?
He's certainly the founder of psychoanalysis, which is, you know, had all of these specific features, many which are not used now. But
would it have been like, for example?
Yeah. Well, you'd come to Freud for your psychoanalysis, and it's something like 5 days a week,
right?
For 50 minutes each time. You'd lie down. You wouldn't face him. It's very important that you don't have a sort of normal, you know, person-to-person relationship, but he has a special status in you. And then you might, in his early days, he would hypnotize people, and then he gave that up. But you might ask people to free associate. You know, he'd say, just let your mind wander. He would certainly ask them to describe their dreams. And then he would interpret them, and he'd talk through them. And it's a very asymmetrical relationship. And Freud had all of these ideas of transference where the patient would see in the therapist and Freud, say, his or her father, his or her lover. And then there's counter-transference, which he warned about, where the therapist then becomes sees the patient in a certain way.
And this is still taught, by the way, like in therapy schools, there is transference and counter-transference. I just want to note that is important.
Well, let me ask you, I think you're more in the weeds here. How common is orthodox Freudian therapy now?
I think it's incredibly rare. And you know, one thing that I wanted to get to at some point was just the idea that, you know, in places like New York, and it's been written up there is this idea that there may be this return of the analyst, which has been very much out of fashion for years. So that's, in a sense, it's all kind of mysterious to me as somebody who has more or less been through what we think of as a modern clinical psychology program, if that makes sense.
I've heard, and this may be exaggerated, that some of the stuff is coming back. There was a period where psychoanalysis is big in New York City. It's big in New Haven, Connecticut, where I taught for many years. It's big in some parts of Europe and South America, but it's quite fading. And I heard this a while ago, that the average age of a member of a prominent psychoanalytic society is like 80. These are not, it's not, because, it's pretty much in decline. And I think even people who would now call themselves Freudian therapists or would acknowledge a deep debt to Freud have much more of an eclectic sort of practice, where maybe it wouldn't be 5 days a week. I mean, that's kind of crazy. It'd be one day a week, or it would be they wouldn't lie on a sofa. Maybe they'd just sit, and there'd be more conversation, and more of a sort of, you know, what they call a therapeutic alliance, where there's just a compassionate person listening to you and giving comments on your life and gentle suggestions and so on. But the and so a lot of the sort of odd bells and whistles would go away. But maybe some of the core stuff, the idea that what somebody is talking to you about, their symptoms, their, you know, maybe they're suffering from depression or panic attacks or anxiety, might reflect something deeper. And one thing that's very valuable for them to do is to talk it through and get some insight into the deep nature of their problems. When I introduce Freud in my intro psych class, I show clips from The Sopranos. Mm. There's Tony Soprano, this mobster, is in therapy with a fairly traditional, reasonably traditional therapist, Dr. Malfi, mm-hmm. and she interprets his dreams and listens to him free associate. It's wonderful television, but it's also not a bad picture of what therapy really looks like from that perspective.
That's an example that most people would know of, and. But I think it's just also interesting, you know, beyond the idea of dream analysis or laying on the sofa, but just as you alluded to, the idea being that if you put two people in a room together within the theory of some type of a healing modality, that something can happen. Like there can be change in a person without giving them medication or without, you know, locking them in an asylum or whatever, that there is something about that tends to work. Because, you know, I'm always just fascinated at the idea of why does that work? Did those figures exist before a Freud? Like, would you go speak to a priest in confession and hope to get a similar result? Would there have been elders you could have, you know, spoken to? But in this case, I think it's really formalizing the idea that something happens in a protected, closed environment with somebody listening, which I still think is pretty interesting.
That's a great issue. And I think you're right. You wouldn't say Freud invented that. Mm. Religious traditions had the idea of somebody you could talk to, you could get advice from. I think that's probably through goes deep in history and across many, many cultures. And I do think when properly done, it works.
Yeah.
There was a stage where psychologists and psychiatrists were extremely enthusiastic about medication. And you know, to some extent, SSRIs and various medications for depression and for anxiety work. They improve people's lives. But I think there's a consensus that they work best in concert with the sort of face-to-face conversation that you're talking about. Mm. And of course, it's something special. Because it's not, you're not just talking with a friend where you take turns giving each other's complaints and give each other advice. You're talking to somebody who is there to help you, right, whose focus is entirely on you, who is sworn to secrecy about whatever you tell them. It's meant to be disinterested in the best way. They're not going to jump in and say, oh, I got a problem just like that, or wait till I tell you this. They're caring about you. And I think there's something tremendously powerful about that. I think there's something powerful about that regarding helping people who suffer from psychological problems. Mm-hmm. And even separate from that, for those of us who sort of suffer from everyday misery, I think that's a Freudian expression, it's useful to have somebody like that to talk with.
My guest this hour is Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, and we're discussing the legacy of Sigmund Freud. We'll be back with part two of our conversation after this short break. This is Life Examined on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. My guest this hour is Paul Bloom, psychologist at the University of Toronto and author of Psyche, The Story of the Human Mind. We've been discussing the work and impact of the Austrian psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud and his complicated legacy in the field of psychology. As we rejoin the conversation, I talk with Bloom about what comes next in psychology. But first, let's hear more about Freud's views on dreams and on women. Let's jump back in. How about just some of the kind of the gender-related questions that would arise out of his theories? I mean, how did he understand women? I mean, were they like hysterical, as some would have referred to women very improperly in those eras? Or did males have a certain dominance psychologically? Like, how do you understand that stuff?
Yeah, I'm sure there are people who try to rescue Freud, and I'm sure there's sort of a sort of feminist reconstruction of Freud out there somewhere. But I think he was awful about women. I think it's pretty clear he used male development and the male mind as the model for what a mind is supposed to be. And so even the story, of course, the Oedipal complex, the story only works for men.
Right.
You know, the boy falls in love with his mom and tries and wants to dispose of his father. And he went through such contortions trying to explain female development, and was candid in his belief that women were psychologically inferior to men in all sorts of ways. More hysterical, less moral, less developed psychologically, with less potential as people. So that part of Freud, you know, simply does not age very well.
Yeah.
It is some of his least supported work. And I don't think there's much of a case for him being particularly enlightened about the difference between men and women.
It's also interesting, kind of, you know, Freud thinking about the idea that he was such probably a large figure and a powerful figure, and how we maybe began to think of as a psychologist as being kind of Freudian, or like sleeping with their clients or acting in ways we think are very improper now. Do you think that like that's kind of true, but also problematic, that kind of stuff is now imbued in, to a certain extent? I think it's outdated, but you know, how we think of like a, you know, psychologist in a New Yorker cartoon or something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yes. I still you know, I'm an experimental psychologist, and it's still a case where if somebody asked me what I do, sitting next to them on a plane, and if I was to say a psychologist, they would start talking about, oh my God, let me tell you about my problems. I have a teenage son, and he's this and everything. I have a friend of mine who has a great response. She says, "I'm a psychologist, but not the sort that helps people."
Uh-huh.
And that's what they tend to go with. So yeah, the clinician, the Freudian clinician, is what comes to mind when many people think of psychologists. Then again, since the rise of B.F. Skinner, there's even a less flattering version, which is the Rat Runner. So, you know, the other sort of New Yorker cartoon has a bunch of white-coated psychologists staring at a maze, watching rats make its way through with some sort of reinforcement. And that's not very flattering either.
Right, yeah. And we could do a whole show on Skinner, and we'll have to come back to him at some point. So after Freud passes, and you mentioned that he died of some type of cancer, that I think it was now suggested because he smoked cigars so kind of seriously throughout his life, Where do his theories go from there? Do people kind of pick them up and run with it, or is he just discarded? What did you see as the aftermath of all the work he did?
So there's different places they went. Within psychology, there were people who his followers had started their own schools. Most famously, Carl Jung, Adler, other people, and there is a sort of modern psychoanalytic school of thought that keeps some Freud but goes in different directions. So, for instance, there's been sort of feminist versions of psychoanalysis that are, you know, much kinder and much fairer to women. So we have that. I don't think it's such a dominant part of psychology now, part of clinical psychology now.
Right.
I would think most clinical psychologists rely on things like cognitive behavioral therapy and medication and talk therapy.
Right.
I think talk therapy is absolutely critical, but not in a Freudian way. To answer your question, I think where Freud went was the humanities. So you're much more likely to hear about Freud from an English professor than a psychologist. There's long been a tremendous interest in Freudian thought in people who study literature, in people who study certain types of philosophy. And in part, it's because his theories, his ideas were so rich. Like in a book, Civilization and Its Discontents, there's a theory of human nature and human evolution that's I think, quirky and weird, but interesting. In part, Freud was a magnificent writer. And he's funny, he's clever, he's you know, he's irresistible to the right sort of humanities professor.
That's what I was wondering, in a sense, is the extent to which he didn't just impact psychology, but maybe, just as you said, the world of art to a certain extent, right? That, or it could have been movements in art or the way that art was expressed. I mean, were there any other interesting examples that, that you have come across or that just that stick out to you?
You know, Freud would often do these biographies, these psychoanalytic biographies of famous people like Leonardo da Vinci.
Huh.
And you see some of that now. You see, you know, occasionally you see, say, you know, Donald Trump being analyzed from a psychoanalytic perspective, talking about his relationship with his father and stuff. And I think there's an irony here, which is Freud thought of himself and took very seriously the idea he was a scientist. But his ideas ended up being picked up outside of science, in like you, as you say, in art, in the humanities. Well, the scientists have largely abandoned him, and I think he's to some extent he's to blame. What one of the core aspects of science is theories that can be tested, that can be proven false.
Yeah,
and Freud had no interest in bringing his work to any sort of empirical test. Time after time after time, he would no matter how things worked out, he'd end up, and this proves me right. And so this was you know, catnip to his followers, to a certain community around him, but it legitimately turned off serious scientists of the mind, who saw this as a non-scientific, more of a cult movement than a science.
That's so fascinating because, you know, you have been in the field of psychology much longer than I have and understand the history of it more than me, but there is this kind of sense of, is psychology a hard science or not, right? Like, how, what is the place of psychology within the sciences if we can't use scientific methods in the way that other fields can? And what I hear you saying is partially is like, Freud didn't really help that.
No, you know? Freud didn't help that at all. And you know, psychologists are very sensitive about being scientists and being thought of scientists as scientists. And maybe this is why many of my colleagues don't want to talk about Freud, you know, and because he didn't help that at all. He had a very unscientific approach to theorizing. I think psychology is, for the most part, a science in that, you know, we develop theories of the mind, we test them, we're at least ideally responsive to the data. Often we blend in with humanities, but also with other sciences like evolutionary biology and neuroscience and neurochemistry and so on. But we have movements within us that are not scientific. And Freud, despite my sort of my admiration of him and my respect for him, in the end wasn't much of a scientist.
I've heard you say that if you could have, you know, dinner with a historical figure, that Freud might actually be somebody you'd like to, you know, share a glass of wine with or a meal with. I love that. I'm just kind of curious, what would you ask him? What would you want to talk about with him if you could do that today?
Oh, wow. I would ask him about what he thought of modern psychology. I would you know, in this imaginary situation, I couldn't resist provoking him a bit. And I'd say, you know, I'd ask him what he felt about being the most famous psychologist alive, but also being largely discredited. And, you know, I would figure, my sense is he was a charming and interesting man. And he would be a great guy to talk with. But certainly, no, so much, such a powerful mind. Not the nicest person. Often he was savage to both his critics, his enemies, but also often savage to his followers.
Has there been anybody that, in a sense, has kind of held up to him in terms of cultural importance? I mean, one thing that I love the way you spoke about, and I think kind of Carl Jung is a little bit in this world, but they were such polymaths, like interested in just so many types of things that I think we don't really have anymore. You know, yeah. That to me, the world feels like we're now kind of a collection of real specialists and we study one thing really, really closely, but we're not really looking at how it might tie, for example, like Freud or Jung to questions of myth or the body or physiology or, you know, whatever it is. And to me, that does seem like an important way of thinking and maybe why some of these people like Freud or Jung were kind of so exceptional.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you could say that sort of breath is not possible now. Mm-hmm. Now that we know so much about different fields, that sort of integrative mode of thought, it just can't be done anymore. If I had to name people who would sort of are Freudian in their influence and in their scope, I would name B.F. Skinner, the founder of behaviorism, in his ambition and his desire to have an all-encompassing theory. Skinner was, in some way, the perfect opposite of Freud. So Freud would tell these baroque stories of hidden, deep psychological processes involving sexuality and your distant past. And Skinner, as a behaviorist, believed that talk of mental life had no place in psychology. Ultimately, for us to be a science, we had to think in terms of stimulus and response, in terms of behavior, in terms of input to the system and output from the system. That the same psychological processes that could explain the behavior of rats and pigeons could explain the behavior of humans perfectly. And I think this program, this intellectual program, behaviorism, turned out to be a disaster. And justifiably, not much has remained of it. But it just reminds me of Freud and his enthusiasm and his personal energy and his willingness to take an idea and push for it. I'll also say as another sort of candidate for a successor in this regard to Freud would be Noam Chomsky. So Noam Chomsky, who is still with us and still doing podcasts, he's in his 90s now. And he founded the modern science of linguistics and, to a large extent, founded cognitive science and has shown tremendous intellectual scope in his contributions, as well as a very broad interest. So unlike Freud and unlike Skinner, Chomsky is very concerned with political matters and social matters. And I think in terms of the power of his mind and his scope, there's something that reminds me of Freud in him. As well as the fact that Chomsky also has his followers and his enemies and has his sort of school of thought.
Yeah, a really important figure. And just to return to Skinner for a second, because I think in my mind, I'm hearing that there's almost an interesting polarity here in the sense of, you know, Freud's notion of the unconscious being so powerful and Skinner saying, no, let's think about this kind of more of the X's and O's. Let's be scientists about behavior. And to me, it gets to a really interesting, just classical debate about what humans are, right? Like,
that's right.
Are we machines or are we these kind of like mystical animals that we don't really understand? And I think that's kind of a debate, right, that goes back way beyond any of these thinkers. I mean, this is a very important conversation that's been happening within humans, I think, for a long time.
That's right. There's sort of a... I think a lazy historical view that viewed behaviorism and Skinner's contribution as a reaction to Freud. So Freud said there's a crazy, crazy theories. And Skinner said, no, it's too much. Let's throw it all out. We're much, much simpler than that. And one reason why he's lazy is that Skinner was fascinated by Freud in a positive way. He talks about Freud more than he talks about anybody else. He tried to get himself psychoanalyzed, but he couldn't afford it. At a point when he was young. And he had a lot of respect for Freud. But I think you're right in that take two pictures. Freud's picture takes humans as unique, takes our minds as extraordinarily complicated, brings in evolution and personal history and culture and society. Skinner strips us down and says, we're just rats in a more complicated environment. And there's no sense, coherent sense of talking about the complexity of the mind because there is no mind. If I had to choose, I would certainly choose Freud.
That's interesting. Can you just say more?
Because Freud gave us our due. Freud acknowledged that there were distinctive aspects of the human mind that you don't find in other creatures. He appreciated the idea that To understand the mind, you have to look within. You can't just look at the behaviors people do. You have to look within. And just like, you know, in the modern age, we often liken our minds to computers.
Yes.
And this isn't a bad analogy. It's one I think Freud might have some sympathy for, where, you know, the workings of a computer are very complicated, and you have to go within and make hypotheses and analyze it. It's not manifest in the computer's actions how it works. And so in some way, you know, you wouldn't psychoanalyze a computer, but you know, now we deal with LLMs, you know, ChatGPT and the like, and people don't know how they work. In part, they don't know how they work because the information is proprietary. In part, they don't know how they work because once they're exposed to enough information, they go off in directions that we don't fully understand. And so, you know, you can imagine yourself as a Freudian psychoanalyst getting one of those things on the couch and questioning it and listening to it and trying to figure out how it works.
Yeah.
And I think an appreciation of that complexity is the right way to look at the mind.
Well, it's also, yeah, and fascinating as these conversations, you know, with AI come online and we think about, you know, how does AI become a person? And then it's, well, then what's a person and how does a mind work and so on and so forth. I think that to me, there's something somewhat comforting in these Freudian ideas of like, we don't really know, and that there is something that's unique or unknowable, or, you know, and you could tie this into the idea of spirit or soul or whatever. But I think we all, in a way, are trying to hold on to some kind of uniqueness in the human experience or the human mind, I think.
Yeah, and in some way, this is maybe another thing that Freud got right. Because on the one hand, it's all of that. He believed in the uniqueness and the specialness of the mind. He believed there was a lot of mysteries that needed to be solved. But he was also had at least a scientific spirit where he believed that these things could be explained through natural law, natural phenomena. That our minds are our brains, that our history and our evolution with enough understanding could give us a sort of naturalistic, scientific understanding of the mind that on the one hand accepts all the complexity and uniqueness that you're talking about, but on the other hand treats it like a natural phenomena, not something which we have to appeal to magic or superstition.
Yeah. Cognitive behavioral therapy right now is kind of the gold standard, and it's very much thought to be the most medical system yeah. in therapy as well. You know, it's something that we think we can track, we can put numbers to, we can try and see how symptoms are coming and going, and hopefully see an arc of healing. And so I you know, I'm wondering where you think we are headed. Is it continuously in a cognitive behavioral therapy model, right, which is more mathematical, certainly compared to the way that a Freudian analysis session would have been, which is, as you have very well said, you know, thinking of dreams and word association. So these are very different schools now. Where do you feel we are at and where this stuff might be going?
I think for all sorts of reasons that you're right, that we are going to focus more on cognitive treatments, on behavioral treatments, certainly on medications, on different drugs. And I feel that for reasons of some good reasons, some, you know, if you suffer from panic attacks, you're probably better off going to somebody for cognitive behavioral therapy than going to a Freudian psychoanalyst. In fact, I take away probably you CBT is the way to go combined with medication.
Right.
Also, if you have obsessive compulsive disorder, if you have bipolar disorder, I think these techniques we're talking about now, the sort of maybe less exciting ones, the less ones that you wouldn't see in a movie, ones that are just less interesting and more mechanical, are those that work. They're also cheaper. They're easier to administer. But I'll say something else, which is that I feel, and I'm not alone in this, that clinical psychology has not made much progress over the last 20 or 30 years. The field seems to be, I'm curious what you think of this, but the field seems to be in a bit of a rut where if you brought somebody back from 30 years ago and said, what's different now in our treatment of people with depression, anxiety, schizophrenics, and so on, they would say not very much.
I think there's a real interesting point there. And there's been major criticisms leveled at the world of psychiatry saying we actually haven't brought a lot of new interesting drugs online either. And I think, in a sense, the whole system is really slowed down or somewhat paralyzed by what people think of are a lack of options in treatment. I don't know if you've heard that similarly, but that's what I hear.
No, I have heard that. There's been the situation with drugs has in some way been terrible, where for financial reasons, there's not much money in creating brand new drugs as opposed to variants of previous drugs.
Right.
And the drugs tend to work, you know, for people with depression, anxiety, and like medication tends to work, but it's not like you go somewhere and you're depressed and say, well, take these pills and then you get better.
Exactly.
They work for some people and not others. Sometimes these drugs stop working. They often have terrible side effects, you know, sexual dysfunction and weight gain and sleep problems. And so people stop taking them. For disorders like schizophrenia, which is one of the most serious, awful mental disorders one could have, we don't know what to do about it. We can't cure it. And you would have thought that we would have made more progress, but we haven't.
Yeah. And I guess just to wrap this up, I mean, this is in a sense also what makes psychology still so interesting to me, which is that there's still so much that we don't know. There's still so many treatments that we don't even think about or know why things work and why things don't. And I don't know, but do you feel similarly that that's where some of the, you know, the excitement still is, or the questions, or why we kind of wake up and think about this stuff?
Oh, it's fun being part of a young science. You know, there's we have discoveries. We know, we've learned things about memory. We've learned things about treatment. We've learned things about language development. We have a lot of discoveries, but there's so much we don't know. And so it's different from being a physicist or a chemist or something, where the science is so developed that only in fairly after going through graduate school and extensive training, then you can make discoveries. But our field is so wide open that just, you know, a smart undergraduate could make a discovery that could transform everything. And I just find that so exhilarating.
Well, it's been such a wonderful pleasure to be joined by Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, and Brooks and Suzanne Reagan, professor emeritus of psychology at Yale University. His most recent book is called The Sweet Spot, The Pleasures of Suffering and the Search for Meaning, and is also the author of Psyche, The Story of the Human Mind. Paul, it's so much fun to explore these ideas with you every time, so thank you for joining us on Life Examined. We appreciate it.
This has been terrific. I hope we could do it again sometime.
That's it for this week on Life Examined. The producer of our show is Andrea Brody. And a reminder, you can connect with me directly, ask me your questions, tell me what you think about the show on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian. You can also connect with other listeners and pose questions on our Facebook group. There's a link to that at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. Make sure to check out the Midweek Reset every Wednesday. Once again, I'm Jonathan Bastian. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you soon.